Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here on the 12th of November. I hope you had a great weekend. Wherever you are, staying warm in the Midwest. I know it's cold all over the Midwest. Temperatures dropping down to even 10 degrees overnight. But regardless of how cold or warm it might be in a given day, we're going to get together like this on Faith Radio Mornings and celebrate the fact that we are part of a kingdom that knows no end. And so as we talk about the news and the topics of the day, we won't do so with an allegiance to maybe Fox News or CNN or MSNBC. We will do this with an allegiance to the eternal kingdom and fix our eyes on Jesus Christ. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot, who do such a great job bringing guests from around our country to talk about these news topics and items of the day. Again, from different angles, different perspectives. You may agree with them sometimes, you may disagree with them sometimes, but trying to bring different angles to the story and believers together walking out this journey. And of course, we do love hearing from you, and we often do throughout the morning, whether it's in a text or in a phone call. And at any point in the morning, if you want to ask one of our guests a question or respond to the comment, you can call us at 877-933-2484. And that same number works for texting into the studio at 877-93-FAITH. Well, we got a great first hour ahead. Our first guest is going to be Matt Sorens, who's regularly contributed to Faith Radio Mornings in the past. He is with World Relief. And Matt and I are going to talk a bit about the ongoing caravan migrant situation just south of the United States border, in which there's multiple caravans that are beginning to merge together, getting closer to the border, some of the policies that the Trump administration is considering at this point, and how the United States is going to handle it when the caravan does reach the southern border. So we'll talk with Matt here in just a minute or so. But before doing that, it would be good to recognize that yesterday, on the 11th of November, it was Veterans Day in our country, and cities from around our Midwest and around our country celebrated in different ways. There are some great honoring memorial services at the Capitol ceremony in Des Moines, Iowa, Bismarck, North Dakota, for example. And we saw in Minneapolis that hundreds gathered in below freezing temperatures for a ceremony held at Flagpole Plaza, a memorial along a 4-mile stretch of Victory Memorial Drive. This drive, Victory Memorial, is surrounded by 568 trees, one for each Hennepin County, Minnesota resident who died in World War I. And so celebrating our veterans, I was looking for some different quotes around war and around the fact that we want to remember and we want to honor those who have fallen. And of course, no less than Abraham Lincoln had a beautiful quote on that, in which he said that in a large sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot hallow this ground, for it is the brave men, living and dead, who struggled here. They are the ones who have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or to detract. I think Lincoln touches on something. If you have been part of a family in which part of your history or sort of your current reality is that somebody has fallen in service of our country, we at Faith Radio Mornings want to say thank you, that we're with you, that we prayed for you this morning, that the God of all comfort would bring comfort and hope into your life. And again, grateful comments from us for Faith Radio Mornings for those who have served our country and fallen. And with that, we'll talk with Matt Sorens next from World Relief on Faith Radio Mornings. About 9 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we are joined now by Matt Sorens of World Relief, who's come on the program several different times talking about some of the immigration conversation and issues that we have at the border of the southern United States. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, great to have you on again. Can you give our listeners a quick update on where we are in terms of the migrant caravan that's making its way, starting from Honduras, but it sounds like joining up with other caravans as well and leaving Mexico City to our border?
Yeah, I mean, that's. I mean, I've only seen press reports on this, but it seems like they're a little bit north of Mexico City at this point. And from what I have read, they said they intend to go to Tijuana, which is not the closest port of entry. It's probably the furthest, which means they still are more than 1,000 miles away. And, you know, it's a slow journey. I've talked to some of my colleagues who do some legal work along the border there in Tijuana, and they're fairly skeptical that, you know, that most of these people are actually going to make it that far. It's a very difficult journey, and this isn't the first sort of caravan like this that we've seen. Usually they sort of diminish over time. This one's been a little bit unique because it's captured so much media attention. People have decided over time to stay back. They don't want to make the trip anymore, or in some cases have been, you know, not allowed into Mexico or have been deported back to Central America or have taken asylum in Mexico. But other people keep joining because it's gotten so much international media attention that I think this is a little bit unusual in that sense. But yeah, we'll have to see exactly who shows up, whether it's at Tijuana or at some other port of entry. But I do think it's really important to keep in mind that, at least from what they're saying, they want to request asylum, which means they are looking to knock on the door of the United States and request lawful permission to enter. It's not the illegal immigration threat that I think sometimes has been talked about in some of the media.
So in light of that, what happens when they do get to a port of entry here? I mean, I saw when they entered Mexico, it was there was a bridge that they were trying to cross, and it got fairly easy for them, even though the Mexican police were shutting down the bridge, to just sort of walk through the water. It wasn't easy, but they were able to walk through the waters and come into Mexico. What happens when they get to a United States port of entry?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what you saw happen in Mexico is, oddly, I think because of all the attention from the United States, I mean, Mexico is actually pretty harsh on Central American immigrants in many cases. They deport a lot of people back to Central America who they don't think have lawful right to access. In a strange way, President Trump isn't actually particularly popular in Mexico right now. So all the pressure from the United States government on the Mexican government to say you need to stop these people probably made it harder for Mexico to stop them, because for domestic political purposes, they don't want to be seen as sort of a pawn of the United States. So, I mean, I don't think it's a matter of Mexico couldn't have kept people out. It's that for their own political reasons, they maybe didn't want to. But I don't expect the United States is just going to let people cross. We have more than, you know, somewhere around 20,000 Border Patrol agents along the U.S.-Mexico border. And then they've also sent the military at this point as well, although they can't perform law enforcement functions under U.S. law. But I don't think it's at all a risk of these people are going to come in without permission. And again, they haven't said they intend to do that. They want to go to the port of entry and request asylum. What happens then, or what should happen under U.S. law, is they're given what's called a credible fear interview, an interview to basically see if they indeed, if their professed fear of persecution or violence back in their country of origin is really credible. And if it is, they are usually put into detention for at least a time and then given a more thorough interview eventually, but that can take a long time because our system's very backlogged for asylum. If they don't pass that initial interview, they're usually deported fairly quickly.
So that's it's an interesting point, because there's been some conversation coming out of Washington, D.C. about the asylum, and that is my understanding correct that the president is thinking about changing the law slightly to say that there cannot be asylum seeking if you have not entered the country legally?
Yeah, in fact, well, it's not changing the law technically, but he basically did an executive order last week, I think it was on Friday, saying the funny thing is, maybe not funny, but the factual thing is, the law says in Section 208 of the Immigration Nationality Act that someone with a well-founded fear of persecution may seek asylum in the United States, whether or not at a designated port of entry. So the law is actually pretty clear that our government allows asylum anywhere along the border, including if you show up at the border crossing illegally. Now, our government can still charge you with unlawful entry, but under the law, you still have the right to request asylum if you can prove that fear of persecution. What the executive order did is basically say, we're not going to accept that. It's pretty unclear to me, just from a legal perspective, how that will hold up legally. I think we've already seen lawsuits filed, and I think it's fairly likely that the courts will find that you know, the president really would need to get Congress to change that law, to change the rules on asylum seeking. But another thing I think is really important to understand, it sounds fairly reasonable. We'll just go to the port of entry. Don't try to cross, you know, between ports of entry. But I was in Tijuana just about a month ago, and there's more than 1,000 people in Tijuana trying to seek asylum who are not being allowed to file their request, at least immediately. They're being told to come back later, and some people have been waiting more than a month with a very, I would say, kind of sketchy informal system of who gets their turn in line to be able to go up to the port of entry to request asylum. And it's mostly Central Americans, Hondurans, Salvadorans, Guatemalans. But there was also people from Cameroon, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, people who, as I couldn't verify, but seemed to be from Ukraine. So it's, you know, and most of those people had come through South America, through Ecuador or Brazil, and made it all the way up trying to request asylum because they're afraid of persecution, they say. And again, I'm not in a position to verify that, but that's the role of the asylum officer, to do that credible fear interview and then a more thorough interview to determine who qualifies under U.S. law and who does not.
Well, and it certainly sounds like some of the countries from which they're departing in Central America and sort of Northern South America really are filled with a lot of corruption and lack of hope, violence, all of these stories that you hear of people unable to even provide for their families if they stay in their country. So are these some of the criteria that we find for asylum seekers?
Yeah, the asylum law is complicated because you mentioned a few different circumstances, and some are clearly would qualify for asylum and some clearly would not. So if you're fleeing poverty, in Guatemala, for example, there's been crop failures. So people are hungry, and those people have a very sympathetic story. I would love to be able to help them, but they do not qualify for asylum if that is their only reason for leaving their country, because asylum is specifically for people who have fled a well-founded fear of persecution, so not a weather-related hunger. But you also have people who are fleeing political violence, where their government is persecuting them because of their race or their religion or their political opinion. And that is the textbook definition of a refugee, and that is people who would qualify for asylum. The complicated sort of middle ground is people who have a really credible fear of violence that is based on gang violence, for example, or domestic violence. Those are cases that not consistently, but were often being approved by immigration judges, by asylum officers a year ago. And there was case law to back that up under, sort of an interpretation of our asylum laws, saying that it was part of their social group that was the reason for the persecution. Attorney General, former Attorney General Sessions, clarified last summer in June that will no longer qualify. So I think we'll see a lower rate of people being approved for asylum. And I think that's what people need to understand. We tell people come the legal way. We keep changing the rules on what the legal way is. It used to be that if you were fleeing gang violence, people were being approved by that under U.S. law. Now that won't be the case. It used to be that you could show up either at a port of entry, but if you were being told, turn yourself around and we'll keep waiting, and it was dangerous, you could go out in the middle of the desert and look for a Border Patrol agent. Now, as of last week, that is not counting either. And so we tell people to come the legal way, but we keep changing the rules on what the legal way is.
We're talking with Matt Sorens of World Relief. And Matt, when we come back from break, getting further into this asylum conversation, we'd love to get some information about what happens if somebody is granted asylum, what are some of their next steps in life, and also those who are not granted asylum, what happens for them. So we'll talk with Matt Sorens more from World Relief about the migrant caravans coming to the southern United States here next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings, where we're chatting with Matt Sorens of World Relief about the migrant caravans coming to the southern United States border here sometime probably in the next month, month and a half, 2 months, somewhere in there, and seeking asylum from some difficult situations in the countries from which they've departed. And Matt, I was asking before the break a little bit, at least previewing the idea of what happens if somebody is then granted asylum. How long is that process from which you requested to where it might get granted? What happens to them next?
Yeah, so when people show up at the border, let's say they go to the port of entry, they say eventually they're allowed to put in their request. And again, they could be delayed a month or more right now, at least at certain ports of entry. But if once they're allowed to present their request, they will be given a credible fear interview. It's a preliminary interview to see if this is if there's a reasonable chance that they would be approved asylum. It doesn't mean you are approved, but it weeds out frivolous cases. And if they pass that level, they usually will put into a detention facility. And depending on if they have children present or not, this is the dynamic we saw last summer. If there's children, there's limits on how long families can be detained or how long children specifically can be detained. So they won't be detained usually more than about 3 weeks under the current policy, though they're trying to change that to make it possible to detain children longer. But once they're released, they're usually released on some sort of a bond in some cases, and they are given a court date to appear for asylum. They're not authorized to work. And at that point, they're not eligible for public benefits, but there are churches along the border and nonprofit groups that will usually help people, get a shower and a meal and get them on a bus to wherever they are intending to be in the United States. Almost all these people have a relative or at least a friend who they were intending to go to somewhere in the U.S. And most of those time those people will wait for their court date, which can be months out. It can even be years out, depending upon which court you're assigned to based on your part of the country. And during that time, again, for at least the first 6 months or so, you're not eligible to even apply for work authorization. So you're usually relying on your friends or family or on the church or someone to help you, sustain you. Again, there's no governmental support for those people at that point. And then eventually you get an asylum hearing. And if you win that, you get legal status. You're eligible for a lot of the benefits that a refugee who's been resettled proactively to the United States and, you know, selected abroad is qualified for. Eventually you're eligible for citizenship 5 years later, basically. If you are denied, unless you have other valid legal status, like let's say you had a temporary tourist visa or student visa that's still valid, in most cases you'd be deported at the point that your asylum claim is denied. But it can be months or even years. That in my mind is the biggest flaw in our system, is our asylum system is so backlogged. In my mind, I really don't understand why we'd be sending military to the U.S.-Mexico border right now. I think we should be sending trained asylum officers. And if we don't have enough of those people, training more of them, so that we can adjudicate cases, let those who qualify in more quickly and get them into work authorization so they can be self-sustaining. And I think that would also deter people who really don't have a good case. And I should be clear, I think we should have more visas for people fleeing poverty, because I think our economy needs it, and I think it would be humanitarian as well. I think it would be a win-win. But I don't think that's the purpose of our asylum system, which is specifically for those who have a well-founded fear of persecution.
Well, you bring up the economy, and it's such a good point. At 3.7% unemployment rate right now, I know that people and jobs and businesses, there's a lot of people and a lot of businesses that need people to work. And so immigration is something that's very important for a country. It often gets demonized, and maybe there's some reasons for that. But immigration really is the lifeblood of a growing economy.
That's right. I mean, it's the only way our population continues to grow, frankly, is immigrants and their children, or we'd have a shrinking population. And almost all economists will tell you that with a shrinking population, it's very difficult to sustain economic growth. And that's why, in some ways, people are using our asylum system as a last-ditch effort, because our immigration system is so backlogged. It's like the last hope for legal immigration is to get to the border. You can't, despite some popular internet rumors, you can't apply for asylum, or at least they don't have an obligation to consider your request for asylum at a U.S. consulate abroad. But if you get to the border, they do have the legal obligation to consider your request, not to let you in, but to consider your request under the terms of U.S. law. And I think we see people who absolutely will qualify, others who really do not qualify, but they're trying their last-ditch effort to get, they're those we see in the base of the Statue of Liberty. They're the teeming masses yearning to breathe free. And I think it'd be much better. I don't really think it's helpful to have children and women or anyone on a caravan walking thousands of miles. It'd be much better if we had a functional visa system overseas that would both meet the needs of the U.S. economy and let us vet people abroad, which is basically what our refugee resettlement program historically has done, but has been so decimated over the last couple of years, to let people figure out closer to home if they qualify or not. And if they do, put them on an airplane in an orderly process where they're met by a team from a local church and an organization like World Relief or others at the airport, rather than having people have to make it to the border to get their answer. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important for people to understand this is not something the United States cannot handle. This is not a threat to our country. This is our asylum laws, people doing the best they can to try to come lawfully with a system that's outdated and not working very well.
Matt, we have just a little over a minute left, but you make a good point there just in terms of our language around it as well. The political rhetoric doesn't seem to help much in this situation, where you have claims of invasion on one side of it, and then you have other side in the extreme saying we should just do away with all border agents. So, as an evangelical Christian, Matt, can you be sort of on both sides of this conversation?
I think the government has its important role, and that includes securing our borders and respecting asylum laws. I think that's what we should expect of our government. But I do think as an evangelical Christian, I want to make sure we don't lose the church's role in this. It's so important that we come alongside the churches that are there on the border helping people in this interim time while they're waiting for an asylum claim to be considered, that we are helping provide legal counsel. These people don't get lawyers they're not assigned lawyers by the U.S. government. World Relief does some of that legal representation. There's other good organizations doing that. And ultimately looking at how do we come alongside churches in Central America and other parts of the world to ameliorate the situations that people feel they have no choice but to flee in the first place. And Central America is one of the most evangelical parts of Latin America. It's probably 40-50% of most of those countries that are evangelical Christians, and most of the rest would consider themselves Catholic. There's lots of opportunities for us to come alongside the church in Central America, in other parts of the world as well, to address the root situations that people are fleeing in the first place.
Oh, Matt, it's incredibly helpful information this morning. We really appreciate the time. And as the situation continues to unfold, we'd love to have you back in for some further updates.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity.
That's great. It's Matt Sorens from World Relief joining us here on Faith Radio Mornings. We'll take a break for Lighten Up and Bottom of the Hour News and continue moving forward here on the 12th of November on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, obviously such troubling news coming out of California as the fire that's sweeping through the foothills in Northern California is now the deadliest in state history. Authorities said last night that what's called Camp Fire north of Sacramento has killed over 30 people now. And in Southern California, another fire is raging northwest of Los Angeles, threatening more than 50,000 homes and forcing more than 250,000 people to evacuate. So one of those moments again where as believers, as we're listening from all around the Midwest and all around our country, that we will pray together for the situation in California.
It's not about having faith. It's about having faith in the right person. This is Jim Garland. In Matthew chapter 9, verse 22, Jesus tells the hemorrhaging woman who has touched the hem of his garment, "Daughter, take courage. Your faith has healed you." But he wasn't talking about faith generally. He meant faith in him, specifically. And that's important for us to remember as well. This world is constantly demanding we have faith in almost everything else. Faith in so-called settled science. Faith in experts. Faith in political ideologies. And in all manner of man-made philosophies. But instead, Christians are called to have faith in God through Jesus Christ alone. Such real faith unleashes the Holy Spirit who does amazing things. And with such true faith, we should be filled. In fact, pray that God would make you faith-filled. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner and delighted to be joined on the line by Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation, who does a lot of research work for them. I know you know Heritage if you're listening this morning. We have a number of guests on from that organization do a great job with us on Faith Radio Mornings. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
So you wrote a book recently here titled When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. What sort of prompted you to write this book, Ryan?
Two things, really. First was we were getting all these requests at the Heritage Foundation about the public policy and legal aspects of gender identity and transgender identities in particular. You know, what to do about bathrooms, locker rooms, sports teams, medicine, the military. We were getting a lot of public policy questions. But then the second thing was that as I started digging into some of the public policy debates, I discovered the real human side of this discussion. It's not just a legal discussion, a policy discussion. And what most captured my thoughts on this were that people who had transitioned, thinking it would bring them wholeness and happiness, and then 5 or 10 or 15 years later, they detransitioned because it hadn't brought them that wholeness and happiness they were looking for. And those stories are really heartbreaking. Those stories are almost never told by the mainstream media. And I thought, you know, I'd written other books. I'd written about marriage. I had written about religious liberty. And I thought I just need to do what I can to try to help people think about what's going on in this transgender moment that we're living in to prevent other people from experiencing this heartbreak.
Well, and certainly that is something that's starting to make its way into some of the headlines. But to your point, the national narrative is that this is sort of a cure-all, fix-all. If somebody is feeling a bit of dysphoria where their biological sex doesn't match up with their psychological sense of their gender. But we see, and you're going to have to help me with the surgeon out of, I believe it's out of Russia, right, that says that one of the top genital reconstructive surgeons says that sex change regret is on the rise and more patients are coming to him to have their gender confirmation surgeries reversed. And that's an incredibly expensive and difficult procedure.
Yeah, and there's no good data here, right? I mean, so when we hear one of the physicians who engages in this sort of medicine saying, wait a minute, too many people are going through with this, and now they're regretting it, he's striking a cautious note, and he's someone who in general is supportive of reassignment procedures. I mean, what's been fascinating to watch is that the ideology surrounding these issues has been moving so quickly that even doctors who were generally willing to think that you could reassign sex are now saying we've gone way too far because we're blocking puberty in children, we're transitioning children, we're transitioning people without doing appropriate mental health screenings, without doing appropriate counseling, without exhausting other possibilities. And now they're being attacked for being transphobic simply because they want a little bit more caution.
Well, and to that point, what has your research sort of shown in terms of how maybe some of the gender dysphoria sorts itself out over time? I know it's not for everybody, but a lot of times, you know, there's this concern at a very early age of if people are playing with maybe gender toys or dolls that are different than their existing gender, we immediately want to transition them. But it seems like over time, if just let the course of events play out, that that gender dysphoria resolves itself.
That is what, according to the DSM-5, so that the handbook for mental health professionals, that's what they report. They report that the best studies show that somewhere around 80 to 95% of young people with a gender identity conflict will naturally grow out of it and will have their gender identity align with their biology if you don't interfere with their development. So if you have a young person who's going through a stage where they don't feel comfortable in their own body, if you just give them the time to continue growing, continue maturing, continue developing, most of the time, 80 to 95% of the time, they'll end up feeling comfortable in their own body with no therapeutic intervention.
Well, and the rise of transgenderism, Ryan, is something that has been relatively recent, and obviously transgenderism has been with us ever since, you know, I've been alive and obviously throughout history, but there seems to be a real significant increase in transgenderism. Is this just because social norms have changed and people feel more freedom to come out as transgender, or are there some social pressures happening as the way we talk about gender in our country? What's fueling some of the rise in transgenderism?
So I think it's a combination of technology, ideology, and then power politics. And what I mean by this is that, first, it's only going to be a plausible idea that you could be a man trapped in a woman's body or a woman trapped in a man's body and that modern medicine could reassign your sex if modern medicine now has those technological capabilities, or at least that they could claim to have those technological capabilities. In actual reality, sex reassignment procedures, they don't reassign sex. What they do is they remove certain body parts and then they construct something that resembles the opposite sexes, but they don't turn a man into a woman. So there's a technological part of this. There's also an ideological part of this. This is only plausible in the late stages of the sexual revolution. It's only after 50 years of the sexual revolution and of the 1960s that we arrive at a moment in which we say that consenting adults should do what they want to do with their bodies, and then we extend that principle to even children could change their bodies. Right? It's not just do with your bodies what you want, but actually change bodies. And lastly, there's a power politics move here. It's not surprising that most of the legal and policy changes took place right after Obergefell, Obergefell being the Supreme Court case that redefined marriage. As soon as the activists won on the marriage issue, they pivoted from the LGB part of the acronym to the T part of the acronym. And because at the time that presidential administration was very sympathetic to LGBT activists, they shifted from what they called marriage equality to trans equality without ever really stopping to think, what does this mean? What does this mean for children? What does this mean for women? What does this mean for the body? And that's where we now find ourselves.
We're talking this morning on Faith Radio Mornings with Dr. Ryan Anderson, who's a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and released the book When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. And Ryan, you talked a bit about some policy procedures and some shifts that have happened over the last maybe 6-8 years in our country. And recently, the president, President Trump, has come out and has tried to narrow the definition of sex and gender, specifically saying that sex has to be male or female, that it's not going to be on a continuum. Where do we see this going at this point?
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of that move from the Trump administration is to respond to an unlawful action that the Obama administration did in its last months of office, where it redefined the word sex in our nation's civil rights laws to mean gender identity. And after they did this, they then said to every school that this means you have to allow students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms and showers according to their gender identity, not according to their biology. The Obama administration then said that all health care plans would have to cover reassignment procedures, that all relevant physicians would have to perform them. So if you're a surgeon who would perform a double mastectomy in the case of cancer, you'd have to perform it for a woman who wants to identify as a man. The Trump administration is simply saying, no, we're not going along with that. The word sex refers to the biological, anatomical, physiological reality. And while people are free to live how they want to, we're not going to be coercing schools and doctors into violating their beliefs, into violating common sense procedures, common sense practices, whether it's a bathroom policy or a medical policy.
Well, it's fascinating to watch because that was one of the obviously points of discussion for many states and many schools, as well as what do we do in terms of who gets a chance to be in what bathroom. It even made its way into some of our retail outlets like Target, and there's a lot of controversy on that. So we're talking with Ryan Anderson here this morning about issues within the transgender movement. We're going to take a short break, and Dr. Anderson, when we come back from break, I would love to get your perspective on some tips for parents too, you know, in terms of if their children are wondering about this or have questions or maybe are experiencing some dysphoria themselves, how we can help parents take steps forward with their kids. So more to come with Dr. Ryan Anderson on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're talking this morning with Dr. Ryan Anderson, who released a book this past year that titled When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. And I know, Ryan, we were talking before the break a little bit about some of the policy shifts, or at least the president making it more explicit in terms of how we're going to identify and define gender moving forward. This was a statement that came out from the Department of Health and Human Services, where it says that sex means a person's status as male or female is based on the immutable biological traits identifiable by or before birth. And so there really is the sense where there's wanting to be a narrowing of the definition so that we can figure out life together. And that's part of what you explore in your book as well.
Yeah, I mean, what's important to realize here is that the word sex refers to how an organism is organized with respect to sexual reproduction. The reason why there are two sexes is because there's a male way in which an organism can be organized and a female way in which an organism can be organized. There are two kind of sex sets of chromosomes, XX and XY. There are two sets of sex organs. There are two sets of sex genitals. And there are two sex gametes, sperm and egg. There's no third sex because there's not a third set of sex chromosomes or sex organs or genitals or gametes. This is why there's a stable binary here, male and female. And this is also how we determine sex across the animal kingdom. This isn't just something that we do for humans. This is something that we do across the animal kingdom. And then it's only become controversial with humans when people want to say that their gender identity determines their sex. But that's not what our law says. Our law and our lawmakers have refused to make gender identity a protected class the way that we make race and sex a protected class, precisely because they know that if you make gender identity a protected class, you would have all of these negative consequences where gender identity is elevated as a protected class. Ideology ends up winning.
Ryan, I know when you're talking some about the biology of this, what have you done any kind of research in terms of how we can think about maybe gender or sexual ambiguity when it comes to the genitalia? I know there's the intersex or hermaphrodite kind of experience people can end up having where it's a bit ambiguous. How do we think about it in those circumstances?
Sure. I mean, what sometimes is referred to as an intersex condition or hermaphrodite condition, the technical scientific medical term is a disorder of sexual development. And that technical label gets this exactly right because ordinarily there's ordered development. And you can see ordered development would result in a male organization, a female organization. But sometimes for a variety of reasons, there can be a disorder in development. And we have disorders in cardiac development. We refer to it as heart disease disorder, and respiratory development, refer to it as lung disease. But there can also be disorders in sexual development. This doesn't negate the sexual binary. This doesn't undermine the reality that sex is an embodied an experience. But it does say that there are some people who, because of either a chromosomal or hormonal abnormality, have a disorder in their development. But they're not a third sex. They're not somewhere in between. They're a male or a female who didn't fully develop, who has somewhere within their developmental trajectory, something went off, something went in a disordered way. And it's important for those individuals and for their families and for their doctors to be able to identify this. Frequently, disorders of sexual development need to be diagnosed shortly after birth so they can receive, those patients can receive appropriate medical care. But this doesn't negate or in any way undermine sex as a concept or how we identify people sexually as male and female. And it has absolutely nothing to do with transgender identities. Frequently with transgender identities, what you have is someone who is fully developed sexually, you know, able-bodied, fully developed physically, but their identity doesn't align with their bodily reality.
Right. It's so helpful to talk about these things because they are so confusing. And certainly when we just maybe catch a bit of a headline or have a family experience, we can kind of define the entire issue from that. So to get into some of the complexity of this, and it is complex, I think, about all the parents listening and grandparents today. Do you have some sort of suggestions, maybe starting with if the school is teaching one thing about transgenderism and gender identity, what would you recommend for a parent or a grandparent to do to be a different kind of voice in their children's lives?
So I would say help your children understand that their biology, it's not something that was just assigned to them at birth. That language of sex assigned at birth suggests that it was arbitrarily slapped on someone and therefore it could be reassigned later in life. Help people to realize that we're incarnate beings, we're embodied beings, and our biology isn't bigotry. We flourish the most when we live in accordance with the truth. We flourish the most when we live in accordance with reality, including the reality of our very selves, our bodily reality. And then part of this would also mean rejecting false stereotypes. A lot of people report feeling gender dysphoria because they feel like they're not living up to societal expectations of what a real man is supposed to be like or what a real woman is supposed to be like. And so what we want to do is embrace bodily reality while rejecting false cultural and societal stereotypes and expectations and norms that have nothing to do with bodily reality. And we can do those things simultaneously. We can say that you are a boy, you are a girl, but not every boy needs to like G.I. Joe. Not every girl needs to like Barbie. Frequently, the transgender ideology actually embraces these stereotypes.
Well, and Ryan, what do we risk losing if we don't hold on to some sort of gender binary here where there really is masculinity and femininity? If we just blur all of this together, is there a sense in which what we lose as a result of that?
Yeah, I mean, so the other error, right? So if one of the errors is the strict stereotypes, the other error is a culture of androgyny, a culture in which people who are advocating for equality end up reducing equality to sameness. So what's important here is to recognize that men and women are equal, but they're not the same. When you see an androgynous culture, frequently what ends up happening is that women have to live as if men. They take the male way of being human, the male body as if it's the norm, and then women are supposed to live as if their bodies are somehow sub-norm, right? And so they compete, they live, they work according to male standards. And so it's important to say that both the female way of being human and the male way of being human are equal. They're equally normal, and therefore our economy, our education system, our political system should take both ways of being human seriously and not have a bad form of androgyny in which, in actuality, it's the male body that gets privileged.
Talking with Ryan Anderson this morning, who's released the book When Harry Became Sally. Ryan, we just have about a minute left or so. If you can gaze into your crystal ball just a bit, what are the trends suggesting? Where do you see this entire thing heading here over the next 3 to 5 years?
I think for the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to be a lot more controversy, unfortunately. I don't think any of this is going to simply go away. And so I think it's going to be vitally important for people like you and me and our listeners right now to equip ourselves, to be educated, to know what's going on, to know how to talk about these issues. I think most of us would probably feel equipped to have a conversation about a controversial topic like abortion, but maybe we aren't as adept in talking to a family member or a friend or a neighbor about gender identity and gender dysphoria and transgender identities. And so it's going to be important to prepare, and then also to be able to talk about these things in a loving and compassionate way. Too much of the discourse, especially over the past several years, keeps getting more and more degraded. Right? There's a lack of civility. And so we need to find a way to talk about these difficult issues in a spirit of charity.
And Brian, thanks for joining us this morning on Faith Radio Mornings. We could keep talking about this, right, for the next several hours. Incredibly important topic. But thanks for giving us just a window into a bit more of the complexity of this and empowering us to think through these issues that are so substantive in our culture today.
Yep, thank you.
We'll take a break here on Faith Radio Mornings and come back with more here next. Special thanks to Dr. Anderson for joining us on what is a tricky topic. It's one of those things I just don't think we can talk enough about in today's day and age, having the conversations that are so confusing so often around sexuality. Well, I see that up next hour, we're really excited to have Dr. David Aikman, who's our regular Monday contributor. Normally only comes on for one segment, but we're going to have him for the full hour on Faith Radio Mornings to get into anything like the 2018 midterm elections, the situation down in South America, all of the events around the globe from a Christian perspective with Dr. David Aikman next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.